Our roll call, we have Drs. Leonetti, Campbell, and Foreman present, and our public member on the board, Mr. John Rhodes, also our Attorney General, Commissioner Etbird, and Executive Director, Heather Grotus, and we have a guest in our audience, Dr. Albert Ulana, who will be joining the board. Very soon. All right, so does anybody have any declaration of conflict of interest to report for the business?
Forgive me, but this is DW. I just want to say that you're going in and out. I hear part of what you say, and then it fades away.
Keep the microphone closer to you.
Okay. All right. We'll try to keep our mics close. So we have a couple people now we're turned on. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. All right. Number four, we have a possible review discussion of our board meeting minutes from October 9th, 2000. The open session minutes. I did not see any issues with
it. Did not.
Okay, well, then I will make a motion to accept the general session meeting minutes of October 9th, 2019, as written.
Second.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? So moved. We'll move on to then number five, our 5A, our investigation files. Our first file today is 19-24-C, is Dr. Melissa Galley. She is present with her attorney, Mr. King. We also have our complainant on the phone. And we also have the investigator on the phone, which is Dr. Cohn. Our complainant's initials are DW, so we'll just remind everybody that that's how we refer to the complainant, with initials and not by name. So I will go ahead and ask Dr. Cohn to please present his investigation report.
Okay, give me 1 second. Hang on. Okay, so this is case 1924C, which is Dr. Melissa Galley. Complaint was DW. DW, allegation was that he underwent surgery in order to be able to return to running. Since he had his surgery by Dr. Galley, he's no longer able to participate in the activities he did prior to surgery, and that he had wished he would be able to participate in after surgery and recovery. Results have resulted in a diagnosis as well as some permanent nerve damage in non-unions. He says he was not adequately informed of the possible complications. Describes himself as in constant pain and has relocated to Virginia. He's concerned as well because he was prescribed a bone stimulator and felt that even though he had relocated, there should be some contact instructing him in the usage of the bone stim. As far as Dr. Galley's written response, the response included a review of the treatment provided. And she stated within the response that the treatment included a pattern of noncompliance by DW. The medical records were reviewed. Patient's initial presentation to Dr. Galley was on February 27, 2018, with a complaint of pain in his left foot, weakness, and swelling. He was at the time 67 years old. It was the left foot and ankle that was painful for him. The pertinent examination at that time involved musculoskeletal, in which there was positive effusion in the left foot. There's pain along the posterior tibial tendon, and the range of motion was decreased at the ankle joint. Had a pes planus bilaterally with a rear foot valgus. Vascular status was within normal limits. There were no open wounds or sores. X-rays of the left foot and ankle were described as having osteoarthritis in the as findings in the subtalar joint. There was a fracture described in the of the posterior talus, resulting in a large ossicle. and there's severe discontinuity of the dorsal surface of the navicular cuneiform joint, indicative possibly of AVN. The assessment was posterior tibial tendinitis and non-displaced fracture of the posterior process, and the plan was to obtain an MRI, which was obtained on March 1st, and identified the pes plano valgus, no evidence of lateral halocalcaneal impingement, but there was concern for fibular impingement, and signs of chronic ankle sprain and moderate osteoarthritis in the navicular cuneiform joint. This was discussed on March 7th, and at the time surgery was recommended, consent was discussed, and the patient elected to proceed. The only addendum I have in here is that the consent is to be put by Dr. Galley. I never had a chance to see the consent. She said she would bring it with her to the to here today. As far as there's an additional telephone call on April 10th, and it was concerned about the patient. It was a discussion which the patient again described himself as being concerned about being able to perform activities to those that he wanted to perform, including running. And Dr. Galley's expectations were noted in this documentation and described that he should be able to be doing a light jog at 6 months postoperatively. April 30, 2018, surgery was performed. It included removal of the posterior talon union, a medial calcaneal displacement osteotomy, navicular cuneiform joint fusion, a bone graft, to the calcaneus posterior tibial tendon, debridement, and primary repair. Procedures in the operative report were described with a lot of with a lack of specificity, and an example of that to me was that she described, and I'll quote, very lax posterior tibial tendon was repaired primarily and reinforced at the site into the navicula, close quote. I don't know whether a portion of tendon is removed, whether it was bundled. Was there a keyhole placed within the navicula? We just don't know what was done based on that. And that's kind of general description of her operative report. There were postoperative visits that occurred. X-rays throughout were typically described as the screws and the fixation intact with the congruous joint. I didn't see X-rays, but I did see the fluoroscopy from the interoperative view, and the screws and the plates were all in appropriate position. A cast had been applied throughout the postoperative visits, which was removed on May 29th. He was to continue to remain non-weight bearing. At approximately 6 weeks postoperatively, which was June 12th, patient was described as having difficulty using compression sockets before prescribed, and had not been able to consistently do physical therapy, which was also prescribed. The X-rays was noted as the sites continuing to heal. Treatment was for patients to start utilizing an ice to prevent any Achilles tendon tightening, and he may begin to weight bear within a boot. Compression socks were recommended with a zipper, so that he could attempt to decrease the edema within, and he was to return in approximately 2 months. August 10, 2018 was approximately 3 months, and he presented. He had been, as noted, he was still limited with physical therapy. He was trying to perform the therapy on his own. Motion at the ankle was equal bilaterally, both active and passively. The recommendations were physical therapy at home and obtain a Therabin and a BAPS board. He was discharged from therapy because of noncompliance August 27, 2018. The issue for him with therapy was an inability to pay. In October 12, 2018, is approximately 6 months postoperatively. Patient was able to put on a hiking boot, was having difficulty wearing those hiking boots, though. He was planning to leave for Florida for personal reasons approximately a month later. X-rays described the fusion sites as healing, and the calcaneus is in good position. October 30, a CT scan was performed because there was continued discomfort and pain, and a possibility of using a bone stim for non-union is identified. and it revealed that calcaneus to be healed with an healed arthrodesis at the midfoot with positive edema. November 7th, the gait was noted to be antalgic, and patient described back issues, which was then referred out for treatment through the same facility Dr. Galley is employed by. November 15th, an MRI was performed on November 17th for his lower back pain. On November 28th, which was approximately 2 months post-op, he continued to have problems with swelling, continued to have problems wearing hiking boots and performing any type of activities. The patient was referred to a spine specialist because of his back. He was also referred for a UCBL, and they had discussion of a possible subtalar joint and talon navicular fusion, which both Dr. Galley and DW did not wish to see with and felt was not desirable from even their initial discussions for treatment due to the need, his want to continue to be as active as possible. This is the visit where Dr. Galley first started describing the patient as being AMA because of his failure to complete his therapy or utilize the socks. December 19th was... He still had not obtained his UCBL because of insurance concerns. He did eventually obtain the UCBL, had discomfort and difficulty getting it to be comfortable for him to utilize. He eventually, in January 29th, was diagnosed with fractured peroneal flat foot, and which was related to the lack of physical therapy. His CT scan was ordered for an addition, and patient recommended for an additional opinion to another podiatrist. This was done on February 8, 2019 by Dr. Ryan. And it was done with the complaint that, where the patient described decreased motion at the ankle joint. The x-rays were taken and reviewed evidence of a delayed union in the midfoot left and collapse of the medial midfoot through the talon navicular joint. Dr. Scott provided two alternatives. One was to utilize the UCBL, and the other was revisional surgery. CT had been scan was performed on March 28th, revealed the navicular cuneiform joint to not have an obvious fusion. EMG nerve conduction studies were ordered on April 12th. April 16th, the patient explained he was relocating to the East Coast. The diagnosis at the time was a pseudoarthritis and a bone stim was ordered. That's the last visit. I did do a patient interview. There were multiple questions. I asked him how he was doing. He described the foot as remaining horrible. I asked him if any conservative care had been performed by Dr. Galley prior to surgery. He states none was prescribed. As you go through, you can review. There are multiple questions that I had asked him. He did admit there were multiple ankle injuries that he had throughout life, but most of them were more than 30 years ago. There were no frequent injuries that occurred. He, as noted, he discontinued his therapy because of financial reasons. He does still use his UCBLs, although they're uncomfortable. My discussion with Dr. Galley and with Mr. Scott King. I questioned why additional care wasn't performed, and she relates that the MRI findings identified progressive issues that required intervention, and the patient had been using orthotics previously. Although the scribe that was assisting her in note-taking at the time did not miss the documentation of the conservative care that had been attempted prior to visitation with Dr. Galley. Dr. Galley agrees it may not have only been a lack of therapy that resulted in the non-union. She felt therapy played a part, however. She felt that the ISYAMA became such a factor so late in the treatments with DW, and she stated it was because the visits seemed to have gotten more and more confrontational, and she felt that the additional documentation was required at that time. As far as additional surgery, and whether she should do any more because of the noncompliance. Her statement was that she felt it would be appropriate to attempt more surgery to provide the correction for a problem that she was treating. As far as my recommendations, I felt this case was unsubstantiated. DW did undergo multiple surgical procedures in a single setting. It's not surprising that the patient has reduced motion within the foot after the amount of surgical procedures performed in the locations. And it would be expected to have limited motion at the time. As far as considering the patient's age and the extent of the work performed for postoperative, it is not unsurprising that a postoperative complication can occur, and it's not necessary. And a postoperative complication alone is not indicative of something being done wrong. As far as the postoperative care and evaluation and referrals, the studies performed by Dr. Galley, they were all appropriate, and they all met within the standard of care. The studies and reviews and second opinions were all appropriate and correct. I felt what patient has or describes is a postoperative complication, and really just a complication. As far as an aside, I was concerned with the lack of conservative care performed or documented, but that would be a discussion I believe Dr. Galley needs to have with her scribes. As far as charges that to finish, the charges that were utilized and billed were fairly high-level visits. We have had discussions of this previously, and I do understand that the problem involves Dr. Galley works for an organization who I believe is mainly involved in performing her charges, but I think that the doctor's charges are excessive and needs to find some way to be involved in making sure that the charges are matching up with CPT guidelines for the podiatric care. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so.
I have no questions for Dr. Cohen, but I would like to see the consent forms and the x-rays. So at whatever time we have those available, that would be.
Okay. So, hang on a
second. One set for everybody?
So you brought us, we have the fluoros on, but what we had any other post-op films, that's what. That's the one that's in.
This
is what's in our packet.
Yeah, so those
so,
are interop.
Yeah, those are interop.
I have tons of things that documented now. I also provided this information.
Right, but we asked for the. When we have an investigation, we need the full chart, and that includes these other postoperative x-rays. Just getting a report isn't.
I can get those. I thought the only thing that you were missing was the immediate post-op, and it all the additional x-rays for our quality. You know, we have somebody who can post it. It's a bunch of x-rays. Do you like them on CG or just mailed to the office? Or how would you like them?
So here's the thing. Dr. Cohen, did you review any x-rays?
The only things I was able to obtain at the time were the intraoperative fluoroscopy studies.
All right. I mean, in this case, what we're trying to evaluate is a fusion procedure that apparently failed and led to a non-union or pseudarthrosis. We'd like to be able to evaluate that on the x-rays the way you were evaluating it postoperatively as we went through the course of the patient's healing. Without those pictures, we don't have anything to judge that by, only your records and the patient's statement. So I don't know how we get to this point in an investigation without x-rays to evaluate. It makes no sense to me. I don't know what
you have a couple options. You can table this matter until we receive the x-rays. That way they can be distributed to the investigator and to the board. Otherwise, you could give Dr. Galley time to bring it up if you feel that that would be helpful right now.
I don't think that's sufficient.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to table it because you're here, we're here, patients on the phone, but you shouldn't get to this point without the board members seeing the x-rays.
And your subpoena that you get for records states
this
is part of it. You just can't piecemeal to us because in this, you know, it affects everybody, you, your attorney, the complainant.
So
I'm going to move that we table this till we get the x-rays. So we have the x-rays. That way Dr. Cohn has time to review those x-rays. We will have time to review them so that we can properly adjudicate and evaluate this.
Second.
Any discussion?
No.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
So moved. So unfortunately, we can't go on. I don't think we'd be fair to you or to the patient to go on with this investigation without having everything we need to evaluate. So
we will get you those images immediately.
Appreciate that.
Patient DW, so this is going to conclude the matter for today. The board has asked for additional x-rays in your case. You'll get a notice from Executive Director Heather Broaddus in the future about rescheduling this matter. Thank you for your participation.
I do have a question.
Sure.
Understanding that I don't know medical terminology, and maybe I missed this because of that ignorance of medical terminology, but nowhere did I hear mention about the impingement that was caused.
I don't think it's appropriate for us to even discuss this anymore since the case has been tabled. So when this comes back up in front of the board, you can bring that up, and maybe at that time it will be addressed. But it's just not appropriate for the board to discuss it at this time. The case has been tabled.
You'll have a chance to address the board again at a future meeting date. We'll let you know when that'll happen.
Is there any anticipation of timetable?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? We couldn't hear you.
Yes. Is there any anticipation of timetable?
We're not sure. The board meets the second Wednesday of every month, so hopefully we'll get those records with enough time to get that scheduled within the next month or two. But it just depends on when we get those records and when they're reviewed by our investigator. But you'll receive a notice.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
I am too.
All right, we will move on to our next complaint, which is Dr. Mark Foreman. Our case number is 1926-C. Dr. Foreman is present with his attorney, Kimberly Kent. And we also have the complainant is also present, so actually I'll have you all sit in the audience. We're going to hear first from Dr. Cohn.
Dr. Campbell, which case?
Just a second here. Our complainant initials are KK. So again, remember, complainant only by initials. And Dr. Cohn, are you ready for your investigation?
I couldn't hear you. I've got several cases, so which case is next?
This is case 19-26-C is Dr. Mark Foreman.
Okay. Yeah, give me a second. I'll have it. Okay. Okay. Okay, I'm ready. Are you good for me to start?
Please.
Okay. This is Dr. Mark Foreman, case 1926-C. The complainant is KK. She and KK alleges that surgery was performed incorrectly, which resulted in permanent damage to the big toe joint, which resulted in additional surgery and the need for her to have the toe fused. She states it was related to the fusion and the second surgery she had to undergo, second and third surgery she had to undergo, was the result of a staple that was placed incorrectly. She also alleges that the consent was inadequate and that Dr. Foreman never addressed the post-operative complications to explain to her that there was a problem with the staple placed within the first MPJ. Dr. Foreman's written response was provided to us by Ms. Gent, Dr. Foreman's legal representative. Included was notice that the surgical procedure was done December 28, 2018. Within the response, he states that, quote, the hardware was intact and in good position and fixation, unquote. Dr. Foreman stated that the staple was close to the base. However, it did not go near the cortex, or he would have utilized a different means of fixation, such as a K-wire. He felt that noncompliance led to the postoperative issues. As far as the medical review, the current allegations, it should be noted this patient had been a previous patient of Dr. Foreman's prior to this complaint by the patient. So the patient initially had been seen by Dr. Foreman in December 2013 for other issues. October 1, 2018 is when KK presented with this complaint of a painful right hallux valgus, which had been identified previously as a structural deformity. Objectively, vascular is intact, neurological is intact, there were no open wounds or sores, musculoskeletal. Patient had a pronated foot bilaterally with pain on palpation of the right first metatarsal phalangeal joint. Motion was reduced at the hallux. X-rays of the right foot revealed increased bursting in the metatarsal angle, degenerative changes in the first metatarsal, and some joint space narrowing and soft tissue swelling, anterior break in the simuline. Discussion of the options occurred for both conservative and surgical intervention. Conservative discussion included therapy, injections, shoe changes. Surgical discussion included a McBride Aiken procedure. On December 14, patient presented for a preoperative discussion for McBride Aiken. A consent was complete. There were signatures, and it did include all the complications. It does appear to be adequate for the procedure in performed. December 28, 2018, surgical procedure was performed. There's no mention of inspection of the first MPJ after placement of the staple within the joint or visualization of the staple to confirm its placement. Intraoperative fluoroscopy was utilized and reviewed. The Aiken itself, to me, appears to be too proximal and resulted in the fixation within the first MPJ being extremely close, and in fact, the staple, of course, one arm of the staple entering the first MPJ. December 31, 2018 is the first postoperative visit. Objectively, there's noted to be good range of motion. Position of the hallux was appropriate, and there were no signs of infection. The X-rays were described as hardware to be in good position and fixation, and patient was to remain non-weight bearing. My review from the X-rays was that the proximal arm of the staple was too proximal to the base, and therefore it did extend into the first metatarsal. If you look at the proximal arm and its 90-degree bend, it is at the dorsal cortex of the proximal phalanx base. So the Aiken osteotomy is identified as being too proximal, and that resulted in the staple being present within the first metatarsal phalangeal joint. We continued our postoperative visits on January 3rd, 2019, and again on January 10, 2019, patient was described as doing well. No signs of infection, and the patient at this time was healing, and there was no good range of motion. X-rays identified mild proximal lateral deviation, otherwise the X-rays were unremarkable, sutures were removed. In my opinion, when reviewing those X-rays, there is no change in position of the staple, and it is within the first metatarsal phalangeal joint. It should be noted the X-rays were supinated, but it still appears to be placed when you compare all three views. Located in the joint. You're extending over the base of the proximal phalanx in the articular surface. January 31, 2019, patient has been using flexor patches for some discomfort. Objectively, there was no, there's a statement that quotes, this drainage is not present with a mild dehiscence, unquote. There's no pain with motion, and there is, in fact, noted to be good motion with no signs of infection. X-rays are unchanged. The view now noted within the plan is more of a hallux rigidus. My view is that the X-rays and the views that this visit are more true, which would be appropriate because of the postoperative time that's gone by, and there's less supination. And yet the AP does still appear to show demonstration of slippage. Does show demonstration of some slippage of the distal portion of the osteotomy on the base of the proximal phalanx. The lateral continues to demonstrate the prong within the joint. February 7, 2019 is a wound check for the dehiscence. Patient was stated to be looking better and not draining. There's a little confusion. I believe on the visit of January 31, he meant to say there was drainage in mild dehiscence, because on this visit he says there's no drainage. I don't think it's a major issue, but there appeared maybe be some confusion with possibly saying not drainage when there was drainage present. March 6, 2019, patients described as having swelling with activities and stiffness in the joint, and the patient is being frustrated, did not proceed with therapy because of the cost. Objectively, there are no signs of infection. There was no pain or motion. The first MPJ was in good alignment. X-rays in this visit described hardware intact, good position, fixation, mild proximal lateral deviation. The Aiken was fully absorbed. Treatment at this time consisted of a cortisone injection within the MPJ. My opinion of the three views was that the first metatarsal phalangeal joint appeared to be narrowing. There was some rotation of the proximal phalanx resulting from the instability of the osteotomy at the proximal phalanx and non-healing of the osteotomy itself. The lateral continues to demonstrate the staple within the joint. Care continues, and on May 5th, 2019, the patient had been in therapy but continues to have issues with the scar opening up. 28 sutures were removed. There had been some sutures placed on May 15th to primarily close the wound. These sutures were removed on May 28th. This was the last visit with Dr. Foreman. On review of the charges for this visit, the multiple charges for visits were appropriate, and utilizing the appropriate CPT codes of a 99203 or X-rays of 73630s. There is an issue to me in that the charts for the surgical procedure was at 28299, which in the CPT book is a double osteotomy. A McBride-Aiken is not typically referred to as a double osteotomy, so I feel that the incorrect coding was utilized here. I did talk with the patient. When I talked with the patient, her main concern was that she stated she was never told that there was a problem with placement of the staples. I asked her how she's progressing at this point, and she states she has sought additional care, and a fusion was performed approximately 6 weeks prior to my discussion with KK. She stated multiple times that Dr. Foreman never discussed that the staple was in the joint, and he never showed her fixation on the X-rays. KK states that she did remove her dressings at one time, which within the response was a question of a compliance issue. She stated it was done because the dressings were too tight, and she immediately returned to Dr. Foreman to have new dressings supplied. I did talk with Dr. Foreman as well, and that discussion included Dr. Foreman and Ms. King. Multiple questions. I asked if Dr. Foreman felt initially the staple, how he felt about the staple, and he stated that he felt initially the staple did not result in the complications. However, later in the care, he did feel the staple was a part of the cause of the complications. Dr. Foreman states he didn't visualize the staple in the first MPJ intraoperatively, therefore he didn't feel it was the initial cause of complications. I asked if he did consider removal with a staple. He stated he didn't document the consideration, but he did have that consideration in mind as a possibility. But his primary thoughts later on in the care was to close the wound dehiscence, which was on May 15, 2009. I asked him about the osteotomy, and he states when he performs these, he does a chylectomy, rather large chylectomy, and that will typically result in increased motion at the first MPJ, and that the procedures performed at the first metatarsal head to remodel that head would include performance of osteotomy, therefore the billing is with correct for 282.99. As far as any other supporting information, KK saw two additional opinions. He went to two different physicians at the, on the same day. One was Dr. Justin Roberts. We received his records on review of his records. It notes that the patient was complaining of swelling within the first MPJ. He did do x-rays, stated the x-rays in the of the foot revealed the staple in the first metatarsal phalangeal joint. There was subluxation of the first metatarsal phalangeal joint and degenerative changes. And his assessment was the staple was in the joint, resulting in the positive degenerative changes, and as well as a possible infectious process based on the history of recurrent dehiscences. His recommendation was to have the hardware removed, followed by a first MPJ fusion. I did concur with the x-rays that were provided. As far as the next opinion that KK obtained was with Dr. Kyle Vaughn at EPM. Similar subjective findings. Objectively, his findings were very similar. Radiographically, his findings were similar. His recommendations were a stage procedure, remove the staple, obtain some deep cultures, biopsy the wound, follow up with a fusion if able to do so. And there was no deep infection. Patient concurred, did perform the biopsy. There was no growth, and they did proceed with the fusion afterwards, which patient is recovering from at this time. As far as my conclusion, I do feel that this case is substantiated. I based that on several factors. I feel the osteotomy at proximal phalanx was too far proximal. And because of that, there was problems from the beginning, especially when using the fixation method that was utilized. I felt that the placement of the osteotomy and then the fixation with the staple, which does appear to be in the joint to myself and apparently was and was verified by the second surgeon who performed additional procedures, resulted in the postoperative complications and the subsequent need for a fusion of a first MPJ. As far as scheduling and removal, everything was documented. The wound healing and the dehiscence that were treated appropriately. But I do feel that procedure itself was placed in a poor position. The staple should have been identified. It was not. Therefore, I felt that was substantiated, and the issues with billing were present as well. Thank you.
Yeah, Dr. Cohen, do you have an opinion as to the reason why there was this problem with wound healing?
There are a couple of issues that have been. One of them, we're dealing with an area that's so superficial and there's no real fat contact that if the staple was placed high up, which it appears to be on the base of the proximal phalanx, there could have been constant irritation on the undersurface in the subcutaneous tissue, and that may have resulted in the dehiscence. I think that's the most likely cause of it.
So
it could have been.
I didn't see any positive cultures or evidence of an infection either through Dr. Foreman's treatment or after the second surgery was performed and bone biopsies were performed. Is that correct?
I didn't get the cultures, but they were from Dr. Vaughn, but it went, Dr. Vaughn did do cultures and they were negative.
Okay.
I could double check to see if we had the results. I felt that Dr. Foreman treated the dehiscence appropriately. Typically, on adhesions, they're superficial, and if you culture them, you're going to get a whole bunch of organisms, and you're going to start chasing bugs, essentially. So I didn't feel that Dr. Foreman's treatment of the dehiscence itself was inappropriate. I think that dehiscence, though, was likely the result of the staple itself. There was never a description of the staple being, of the skin being eroded to the point that the tissue was exposed and the staple was exposed. So I did not, I would not have expected any kind of a problem or from Dr. Foreman. As far as the Dr. Kyle, the podiatrist who did do the surgery, Kyle Vaughn, he did do bone cultures and does note within his notes that the cultures were all negative, and that's why he proceeded to do the second surgical procedure. Otherwise, he would have placed that patient on IV antibiotics with a PIC for 6 weeks and treated for osteo.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have any questions at this time. So at this time, KK, you can come and have a seat, and we'll give you 10 minutes to give us your summary of your complaint.
All right, where do I start? Before this procedure, let me explain my lifestyle. I'm 53 years old. I am denested. I am was an active person, working out 5 times a week, playing sand volleyball, playing tennis. Very active person. I'm going to get emotional because it's been 10 months of this, so I apologize. I went in for surgery on December 28th. I was told nothing was wrong. The surgery went fine. I was never told there was a staple in my foot. At any point in time, there was no talk of putting any hardware in my foot. Because the next time I went for surgery with Dr. Vaughn, I said, wait a minute. I asked for complications with metal. There was no discussion of any metal going in my foot. I was reassured at every visit that everything was fine. I was never showed an x-ray. The first time I saw a staple in my foot was on June 18th when I saw Dr. Vaughn. And I opened up the file they had finally released to me, which took 3 weeks to get my medical files, and there's a staple in my toe. And I'm like, why is there a piece of metal in my foot? So let me back up a little bit. The surgery was December 28th. I complained of pain. It was mostly the swelling. There was no motion in that toe for over 2 months. There was so much swelling, you couldn't bend it to get any motion to feel the staple in there. At 2 months, he put a cortisone shot in my foot because I was complaining about all the inflammation. I've heard from other doctors, and I'm an athlete, that I know cortisone is never a good idea. My current doctor says that just destroys and inhibits healing. To me, he was trying to cover up what he did. That's my impression of it. At 3 months, I'm still not making any progress. He's telling me to go to physical therapy. Well, I go to physical therapy. I'm in an extreme amount of pain, and I had to go to 2 physical therapists over 6 weeks. They flipped me to somebody else because they couldn't figure out why I was having so much pain when I actually got to finally start bending my joint. Well, I didn't know there was a staple on my joint. Do you know what it's like to have a staple digging into your joint nonstop? And she's trying to pop my joint. She kept trying to pop my joint, and she couldn't pop it. She couldn't pop it because there was a staple in there holding it together. Then the suture starts opening up over and over again. And I go in there 4.5 months. He says, how are you doing? I'm like, I've been through physical therapy. It's not any better. It hurts like hell when I finally when I can bend that joint finally. It hurts like I'm getting stabbed with a knife in my foot, in my joint. Does nothing. Stitches me up, sends me on my way. I've never seen an x-ray to this date that I can remember. Okay, that's just my memory. I start calling around to other doctors because I have 2 physical therapists telling me something's wrong. And I had another person I was going to, another PT that was out of network, telling me the same thing. This does not look right. Something is wrong. I call up doctors. They won't typically see you for 6 months after a bunion surgery, if not a year. They want everything to settle down and heal up, right? Well, I talked to someone at TOCA. I set an appointment for July. In the meantime,
I found out this little rule. I called up another doctor, Dr. Vaughn, and I just didn't say I had surgery. I just said, I have a bunion problem. They got me in June 18th. I went to the appointment, and I told my daughter before I left, don't expect me to come home in a good mood because I know something's seriously wrong. It's been 5.5 months, and this something is seriously wrong. Dr. Vaughn gives me all the bad news. This was never done correctly. The cut was too close to the joint. You've got a staple in your joint. We need to get it out of there. It's basically destroyed your joint. You have no more joint. It's going to have to be fused. But first, we have to do the surgery, get the staple out, and check for bone infection because the suture has never closed up. It just keeps opening up over. Even at the 5.5 month mark, it was opening back up again. So here I am walking out of a doctor's office knowing I am in store for 2 more surgeries. I feel like I've been lied to for 5.5 months from my original doctor, which I've never seen before. I have been to doctors. I have never seen this just blatantly lying to me visit after visit, saying everything's fine, go to physical therapy, what's your problem? You should be running by now at 3 months. Well, I wasn't. Should have been a sign that the staple that I didn't know about was in the wrong place. So after seeing the second doctor that day, he confirmed everything. He said exactly the same thing, and we moved forward with Dr. Vaughn. So I had to go through the emotional stress of thinking I had a bone infection and go through another surgery. That one was quick, 20 minutes out. The second one, I had to wait 6 weeks, make sure we didn't have an infection. I was under for 1.5 hours. Have you seen the latest x-ray before surgery? It is ugly. My toe has completely moved over. It's before and after is ridiculous. He spent 1.5 hours getting rid of scar tissue and recreating the joint and putting it back in line because it was so out of place. Literally. I was so sick from the anesthesia that second time around. I slept like 10 hours a night for like 2 weeks straight, wondering if I was going to just be done with this. And I'm still having issues even as of today. It's been about 12 weeks post-op from the last surgery. I have to go back in today because with the fusion, I wasn't really told this either. The toe gets pointed up, and guess what? The toenail's getting into the problem when you put on regular boots. There's a problem. I still have a lot of swelling. I woke up this morning at 5:15. My foot is still swelling. It's going to be another probably 3 months to see if I'm even going to get my functionality back. They keep saying this was the fix, this is what you should do. But guess what? After what I went through, I don't believe anybody, which is really sad. I do believe Dr. Vaughn. I think he's a good doctor. But after going through this, and basically 2 doctors basically telling me he totally screwed up and lied to me from day one is aggravating. And I can see when someone messes up. I get it. But to sit there and cover it up, and I probably could have had my joint still if he would have just owned up to his mistake. And I'm not surprised he double-charged me. You know, you bring up the fact that he double-billed for that surgery. Guess what? The first time he tried to schedule my surgery, he sent me to an out-of-network outpatient facility, and I didn't know this. I had to switch it to an in-network facility, and they had me almost trying to sign forms that were basically fraudulent, saying, oh, if this is out of network, don't worry about it. You know, just claim that you're indigent and you don't make enough money to get balance billed. So I called up their office going, what are you trying to have me sign here? I'm in the insurance industry. I work for Cigna Healthcare, okay? I'm not in this area. I'm an underwriter. I just deal with numbers. I'm a numbers person. But going out of network is never a good idea and not being informed of it. Number two, on the financial side, he prescribed me a $2,500 drug called Duoxin. I talked to the pharmacist. I go, what is this? I have a deductible. He goes, yeah, just go get some Motrin and some Pepcid AC. It's the same stuff. I was going to get charged $2,500 through my insurance, and it would have hit my bill. Financially, I don't really care. I just want my life back. I seriously do. I don't know if I'm going to get it back because of him. I think he could have saved my foot. I could have still had my joint. And I think he's lying to you. I think he knows he screwed up from day one. And the reason I'm saying that is because 2 other doctors told me that. I mean, what other doctors rat out another doctor? I've never seen it. They're like, you need to file. They basically said, if you need to file a complaint, I've got basically everything documented for you. Don't worry about it. I got your back. But now that I see that he sits on your board, I don't know what kind of ramifications that's going to mean for him. I just think what he did was unethical. We all make mistakes. I make mistakes financially, whenever. You know, it happens. And we make mistakes in our jobs. But I feel like he tried to cover it up and didn't own up to it. Because the first two doctors I went to in one day were like, oh, yeah, this is completely messed up. It was never going to heal. He destroyed part of my toe bone. I've got, you know, the toe that he actually cut into, my big toe is significantly shorter than my second toe. So they're saying this is going to work, but is it really when you shorten my big toe now downward as well? I'm not buying it. I don't know if this is going to work or not. He's permanently impacted my life. Socially, economically, I could have lost my job. I work from home for at least 4 weeks after every surgery. I said, I'm not coming in. And I had the flexibility, thank God. Otherwise, any other job, you probably would have been canned. I mean, we all do work from home now. But just ethically, I just don't see it. I'm sorry. I don't see what he was thinking. I don't get it. I don't understand it. And I'm disappointed in him.
I don't have any questions. I think it's pretty simple.
And I don't have any concerns about the infection. There was no infection, but my current doctor thinks because the staple was moving around so much, that was causing the incision to open back up because it was just causing, I don't know. He just said, because I was worried. I go, there was no infection. Why did it keep opening up? And he said it was probably just moving around enough to irritate the suture and just open it right back up again throughout the course of those 6 months. But the stress and the emotional impact of this for 10 months is ridiculous.
I just had a couple questions. Did you have any trauma to your foot after your surgery? You didn't fall? Or
zero.
Anything? Okay. And any time during your care, did you ever see your x-rays?
No, not that I, no. I don't, I remember them, the assistant pulling them up, but I don't look at them. I'm not a doctor. What am I going to view?
But nobody ever, I mean, to explain to you and show you.
Nope.
When they pulled them up, was it on a laptop like this, or was it like a film that they put on a...
It was like an old-school computer on a desk. So she would pull them up, the nurse or assistant, and she'd look at them, and he would come in and say, everything looks great or whatever, how you doing, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
Because if I would have seen an x-ray with the metal in it, I would have questioned it. I am an analytical person, and that's the first thing I did when I did get my file. I was sitting in Dr. Vaughn's office, and I was I'm like, why is there metal in my foot? And I walked into the appointment, and he came in finally. I said, just tell me. I know it's bad. Just tell me.
So when you had the preoperative appointment where Dr. Foreman and his staff review the procedure that was going to be performed, one of the things they told you is that they were going to make a cut in the bone and realign it and use something to hold it in place, correct?
No. So my first appointment with him in September when he told me something was wrong, you know, how to fix this, I thought it was just going to be shaving down the bunion, right? When I go in there in December, they say, oh, no, we're shaving down the bunion. We're putting a cut in the toe bone. What was the other thing? There was no mention of anything being put in there to hold the toe together. I don't remember that.
Okay. But he did tell you they were going to cut the bone.
Yes, I do remember that. Because I asked about that. I go, you're going to cut a bone. Why? How does that, you know, I don't get it.
Okay.
And I was told by two other surgeons this is not the way to do this. This is a shortcut way to do a surgery. Now, I don't know if that's accurate or not. Again, that's just here. He said, one of them said, this is not the way I would have done it. It's the shortened version or not the greatest way to approach this. But again, that's not the issue. The issue is doing it correctly and then not fessing up to what he did.
Yeah, I would think that statement is incorrect. I think the McBride-Aiken, which is kind of the technical term for what you had done, is probably one of the most common bunion procedures out there.
Okay, and that's fine. That's fine. I have no issues with that. My problem, again, is it not being done correctly and not owning up to it.
Okay. So, I mean, at least on the, yeah, on the pictures, on the consent form, it looks like he made a little diagram that you signed where he took a wedge out of the bone. So that,
No, I remember him saying there was going to be a wedge taken out of the bone. I didn't realize there was going to be any metal put in there. But even if he had told me there was metal going to be put in there, he obviously did the procedure wrong, and it was in the wrong place. My current surgeon showed me the staple's not even in the right, it's not even turned the right way. He showed me a picture afterwards. I'm like, I don't want to see any post-op surgery pictures of my foot. I just don't want to see it, but he showed me. He goes, it's not even going in the right direction. He's like, there's no way that way this cut was made, it could ever have worked. He goes, the cut was made in the wrong place. That's what my current surgeon's telling me.
So if Dr. Foreman told you he was going to put a staple in your foot, would you have still had the procedure done?
I don't know. Probably, if it's done correctly.
Okay, so that wasn't a defining moment for you, whether that...
No, it was the surprise that there was metal in my foot, and being in therapy for 6 weeks and literally doing their exercises, and they're saying, I mean, to just do that, I can't do it now because, of course, my toe is fused, but, you know, you're doing a lot of this, like my good foot, and I'm doing this, and I'm grimacing. Like, what's wrong? I'm like, it kills. No, and they had no idea there was a staple in my foot, or they wouldn't have had me doing it. She wouldn't have been trying to, like, pop my joint if she knew there was a staple in my joint. She wouldn't have been doing it. Two of them threw up their hands and go, we can't help you anymore.
So when she was popping your joint, was she pulling on the end of the toe?
Yeah, she was very slowly for about a minute, she tried to get it to pop, and she's like, it's so close, I don't understand why it won't give. And that's when she gave me to the other guy. She gave me to a guy named Pete. She's like, here, I'm going to have you work with basically somebody else. And I went to him for about 6, 8, 10 visits. And he literally was cupping the bottom of my foot. And I think there was a problem with my the muscles. They weren't relaxing. So the muscles were relaxing. I said, well, you fix the muscles. They're relaxing. But it still hurts when I bend it. And he's like, he goes, you need to, he basically was telling me, you need to go to another, he goes, go to a different surgeon. They all knew something was wrong, and they didn't want to really say it out loud, but their whole body language was, you need to go find a new doctor and find out what's wrong with your foot.
I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Yeah, didn't your physical therapist, they didn't have x-rays to look at or anything? I mean,
I doubt it. I don't know.
They don't always ask, although it's, I just had that this week. A physical therapist requested my post-op x-rays because I guess they wanted to know what was done. And if the bone was fused before they started doing range of motion exercises like pulling on this, which is never a good thing when there's an osteotomy. So, but generally, no, physical therapists don't ask for x-rays. And they don't take them themselves.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Apologize for being so emotional.
Thank you for your time.
Hey, Dr. Leonetti?
Yes.
Sorry. Just in case, you know, within the notes, I had time to look. There is the culture reports from Honor Health for KK within Dr. Vaughn's notes. So if you wanted to look at the bone culture yourself, it's there.
Yeah, I saw those, but I wasn't sure if there was anything prior to that from Dr. Foreman's office that would lead you to believe that there was an infection going on and that was the cause of dehiscence.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No, I felt what I did then, that the staple was, you know, the movement of the staple being shallow. That's what I thought.
All righty.
Yeah, so, thank you.
Confidentiality. I hired another expert and was ready to get his report and got the report. So that became a conflict, and I quickly had to hire another expert. Otherwise, I apologize for not being able to get this report sooner. That's why that happened. I draw your attention to the noise of anything that you're doing. normally I would hand this to Dr. Cohen. I forgot, and he did tell me that he's no longer coming here, but normally I would hand it to him. That's how I wanted to start this morning.
Yeah, I've had a chance to review this already. And while we're reading this, just a point of information, do we have pre-op x-rays available on this patient? I've seen the fluoroscopy. I've seen the post-op. I haven't seen the pre-op. Unless I'm missing something.
Everything was given to Dr. Cohen.
But some of those were very poor quality. Dr. Cohen, did you have a pre-op x-ray on this patient, on KK?
Jerry?
Dr. Cohen, are you there?
You're falling off.
I had you on mute. Sorry. Yeah, I'm working.
Uh-oh. Do you have pre-op x-rays from KK?
Hold on. I'm looking through mine to see again. Hold on. January 21. Hang on.
I have a question about this. I agree with you.
I'm not seeing them.
In your study group. All the best notes.
They don't have any.
They weren't very good. Are your x-rays digital?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so when you bring up an x-ray in your office, it's going to be on a screen.
Yes, it's on the screen right next to
film.
No, and okay. The patient can see it from the treatment chair.
Do you find anything, Dr. Cohen? Well, while you're looking, we can proceed.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not critical.
Right. So, Ms. Kent, are you going to present or... As I know you wrote us a lengthy...
Dr. Campbell, is it all right if I reserve my remarks for the end?
Yes, ma'am.
I would rather reserve my remarks for the end, and my client will answer any questions. Okay.
So, Dr. Foreman, why don't you go ahead and give yourself...
That'll give us our... First, I'd like to, clarify some things. When we went over the consent form, the patient, we did review it, and... medical assistant can testify to that we go over, and I don't just say we make a wedge of bone and what am I going to put in it? I'm just not going to leave it in there. I'm not doing a minimal invasive surgery. So I actually draw a line on it, and I think the consent form has that line on it that's mimicking the staple. Okay, so so I do go over that with everybody. I try to go over the whole procedure with the patient preoperatively, so we ask every question, because I like the questions beforehand instead of after the surgery. I want to clarify with Dr. Cohen. I mistook what he said with the staple. I thought he meant later on, after the views I saw from the other doctors, if that contributed to it, not my statement later on in the case. As for the staple placement, I was in the subchondral bone. There was no visible staple present, or I would have removed the staple. I wouldn't have left the operating room. I flushed the area, as I normally do, and it was in the subchondral plate. I would have put in a K-wire or some other form of fixation if it wasn't in there, and I saw it. The images that I took later on were the same as the fluoroscopy, and sometimes the concavity of the proximal phalanx, the bone, the staple doesn't look like it's in the correct place. So the concavity of it with the proximal leg was not in the bone, and I visualized that before I closed. Thus, the x-rays I took later looked like the fluoroscopy, and it didn't shift. And that's why I didn't think the staple was in the wrong place. As for, I'll answer any other questions.
So, was there discussion with you and the patient about any type of internal fixation?
Yes. As I mentioned, when we go over the consent forms, I take a wedge. I draw a little pie-shaped wedge, and then I draw a line through it and say it's a staple, because there has to be some form of fixation unless I'm doing minimal invasive surgery, and then we have to keep it propped over for 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay. Was the patient non-weight-bearing post-op?
In a partial weight-bearing in a cam walker boot.
In a cam walker. Okay. And that was done?
Yes.
Best of your knowledge. Okay. Did you go over the x-rays with the patients post-operatively?
The x-rays were right next to the treatment desk, so a patient visualized them. I show them in every appointment. I didn't hide anything. They were opened up on the x-ray screen next to, and the patient could visualize that. If the patient doesn't see, then they usually ask, can I see the x-rays, and they come closer to the x-ray, because I do enlarge the film. I did show the x-rays at every visit. Again, I can have my medical assistant testify to that.
So if you had a screen open to these pictures and the patient saw it, it's pretty hard not to notice that there's a piece of metal, whether a staple or a screw or a pin or something, in the foot.
Right.
You gave a cortisone injection to this patient's joint. What was the thinking behind that?
Since there was already arthritis and there was inflammation, I wanted to relax the joint a little bit so the swelling would go down and the soft tissue swelling would thin out, and over time the patient would have improved pain level and swelling.
Okay. Did you say that the patient had already had degenerative changes in the joint prior to the procedure?
Yes. I mentioned that on the first x-ray we took, that there was joint space narrowing and degenerative changes present.
This was prior to the procedure?
Prior to the surgery.
Is that during the pre-op visit or during the bunion visit?
It was probably before. It was October 1st.
It's October 1st. Okay, so I'm looking at that right now. For the board members, it's page 579.
Thank you.
What page?
This is 579 in your materials. It would be the October 1st office visit prior to. The October visit? October 1st? After that, yeah, you did not see the patient again until December 14th. Pre-op.
Where?
December 14th, there were pre-op x-rays taken in the office.
That in the x-ray review? Yeah. Okay. Oh. Okay. So when you placed the staple intraoperatively, you were able to visualize the joint?
Correct.
And there was no staple poking through the cartilage?
No, there was no staple. When I flushed it, I...
And when you were evaluating this patient postoperatively, what do you think was going on with the wound healing?
Well, the patient was using a TENS unit, and she did one time put it right over the wound, over the incision site, excuse me, and that could have caused some dehiscence, some rubbing on it could have caused a dehiscence, motion.
But
there was no signs of infection throughout the entire procedure, surgery, and post-op visit until I saw her. So that's what's it.
And the duoxin? What is
Duexis?
Duexis
is an NSAID, and they're supposed to have a copay card that they're not supposed to pay more than $25. That's the only reason, because that one has a stomach blocker also.
Is this at one of those specialty pharmacies, like
yes, and
Z or one of those?
Yeah. Just it's for patients that are going to be on NSAID therapy for longer than a few years.
Okay, because there are several of those medications, the antifungals in particular. If you go to the certain pharmacies, it's $25. If they go to the corner Walgreens, it's $600. So yeah, all right, that makes sense. I have some other comments, but...
Doc, from how often do you use a staple?
Pretty much exclusively.
So when you put that staple in, you felt it engage both sides of your osteotomy?
Yes.
And with regards to the billing, with the McBride, it's an osteotomy, and so is a chylectomy. So I'm having a little question here of how you can charge for a double osteotomy when a chylectomy is only removing exuberant osteophyte. You're not cutting a wedge and removing the real body. So is that how you're billing? You know, is that the standard for your billing company, or is that your standard?
That's what the billers in the recent meetings I went to stated to do with Nakin and another proximal osteotomy.
So normally the way it would be billed would be a 28292 for the McBride and then a 28310. So it would be billed as two separate procedures because you basically could do two separate procedures. But what's happening now is it's being billed as one procedure with a 28299. It's a double osteotomy, even though McBride isn't your classic definition of an osteotomy. It's six to one, half a dozen the other. You didn't double bill the procedure. You billed a double osteotomy. If it was done the other way, you would have billed two procedures. So it's, you know, that's not a big concern for me. I don't think the doctor's going to make any more money with a 28299 than with the two different procedures. It's just a matter of how you interpret the 28299. So, I mean, that's, yeah.
So you always, but you pretty, well, how much at most of the time when you're doing your McBride's that you do a chylectomy with?
Well, I removed the dorsal aspect of the first metatarsal, any kind of lipping that's there. When I'm putting the staple in, when I'm doing Nakin, I also remove the base of any kind of proximal phalanx lifting, and sometimes do a chondroplasty if I see the general changes inside the joint.
And then on your op report, you noted the condition of the particular surface, discoloration.
There's some degenerative changes.
So it was more dorsal, or was it more
planted? It was dorsal. It has
Which
a
visit?
this would be in, this is intra, what was, where is the op report? Do you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for, what my page number is. Op report
676.
Oops. Or who's this?
No, there's no Bates on it. It just says op report page 1 of 3.
On our
computer.
Yeah, it's
the cartilage of the central portion of the first metatarsal head showed discoloration and atrophy.
There was already signs of degeneration then.
Okay. What are you?
10% of the joint.
So was it cystic or?
The cartilage was worn out in that area. I didn't find any.
Well, I didn't see the pre-ops, but I didn't see any post-op. No. Yeah, there was one thing.
And the patient, there was no diabetes or no immunocompromised status of this patient.
Is part of the preoperative consult complications what potentially can happen with these type of procedures?
Yes, and on that list it does say heart wear. Need for future surgery. Yeah,
I saw your consent. I saw the written consent and the list of potential complications. But I mean, there's actual discussion that happens, not just sign a paper. It's like, you know, sometimes you'll have pain, sometimes you, you know, doesn't, you know, we could do this and.
Yes.
Well,
yeah, I've got a couple. This fixation device that was used, the staple, it, you know, it clearly it shows it was misaligned and in the joint. But was there some other type of fixation, that K-wire or something, that could have been used?
Yeah, if I saw it going through the joint, I would have removed it and used the K-wire, yes.
That's all.
So I have a comment about the x-rays and about what I see is happening here. If we look at the immediate post-op, and I can't really evaluate the intraoperative x-rays because they're kind of blurry, the fluoroscopy, so I don't really know. I don't know if anybody has a better picture of those. But at least on the first post-operative x-ray on 1231, if you look at the lateral x-ray, the proximal arm of the staple, there is still bone between the arm and the staple proximally. So staple from the dorsal surface looking down is in the cortex of the bone. Dr. Foreman mentioned this, and this is correct. The base of the proximal phalanx is concave. So the staple's going through the bone dorsally, and on this view, it looks like it's in the immediate subchondral bone. So it could be in that soft bone underneath the cartilage, but still in bone. not real hard bone, but still in bone. So you could look in the joint during this procedure after the staple is placed and not see any metal arm. Even though you look at the pictures and you say, oh, it looks like it might be in the joint, it's possible that this is in the subchondral bone and in the cartilage, which you can't see on the x-ray, and it's covering the arm of the staple. So technically not in the joint, and I think, you know, you look at this and you just go, oh, it's in the joint. That may not be an accurate description, and I think Dr. Discont noted that in his report. But here's what it looks like is happening to me. It looks like the lateral wedge of the Aiken broke and the proximal phalanx shifted. It shifted laterally, and as it shifted, now the staple's going to move. And as the staple moves, because you have an unstable osteotomy, it's going to break through the cartilage because it's soft. And as it breaks through the cartilage, then you have this degenerative condition that's already started worsen. And then you have the breakdown of that base of the proximal phalanx because of the degeneration and an osteotomy that's not healing very well. And that is this snowball going downhill that started. I think if the lateral cortex wouldn't have broken, there wouldn't have been motion at the osteotomy, the staple wouldn't have moved, and should have healed. I mean, I rarely see Aikens that don't heal. Even some, the old days, that they didn't even fixate them. They would just tape the toe and they healed. So, but I think this was that snowball going downhill that once the cortex broke and the proximal phalanx shifted. And why is the cortex broke? It breaks because of motion. Moving the hallux too soon before the bone heals. So once you develop that degenerative changes in the joint, it looks like the x-rays that Dr. Vaughn and I believe it's Dr. Roberts saw. And of course, if you look at those, you say, oh, wow, this is a degenerative joint, staples now in the joint, and that was the cause of it. The only option here is a joint fusion, which is not the only option at that point. And with the wound dehiscence, my first concern would be, is there a bone infection? Didn't look like Dr. Foreman diagnosed an infection, and certainly it looks like from Dr. Vaughn's procedure and biopsies there was no bone infection or deep infection. So infection wasn't the cause of it. Dr. Cohen made some reference of the staple being too high, but if you look at the lateral on the first postoperative visit, I mean, the staple can't be buried any farther than it is. The bottom of the transverse arm of the staple is up against the bone on the proximal phalanx, so that can't get any deeper. So I think the reason why there was dehiscence because that back to that lateral cortex that broke, and now the bone is shifting and there's motion there. So, but there were other options, whether it's an arthroplasty and remove that bad bone and leave it with a Keller, or use a hemi implant, or use a silastic total implant, or use an arthrosurface implant that would have maintained motion for this patient so that she could be more active than a fused first MPJ. Unfortunately, there's just some doctors that have one method of treatment for a degenerative first MPJ, and that's a fusion. And that's fine for them. If that works for them, that's fine. But there are other options that are available.
If you watch, too, I'm looking again here at these laterals, you see then as that fracture happens, then you've got the staple is actually lifting up dorsally and
yep.
turning.
Yeah. So my question to Dr. Foreman, was there ever a concern that the lateral cortex breaking was the issue?
With her pain?
With her pain and with her not healing quickly and maybe the swelling, I mean, that sounds like, you know, the culmination of everything that she was going through is because she basically fractured that lateral cortex, which caused motion, which would cause pain, which would cause swelling, which would cause dehiscence, which would cause the staple to move. I mean, all that comes from that. And the treatment in my mind, probably would not have been an aggressive physical therapy. Certainly, I wouldn't want anybody pulling on this toe. No way. All you're going to do is separate that osteotomy and make it worse. I mean, physical therapy in the form of heat, cold, massage, ASTEM, non-aggressive type of motions would be fine. But any aggressive range of motion or distraction is only going to make this worse. That's apparently what happened. So,
PT started when?
So, Dr. Campbell, the patient was ordered to have PT. Conservative PT started about 4 weeks postoperatively.
5:15.
Later, doctor learned that she did not comply with those orders. She did not start physical therapy records until April, which is about 3 months postoperatively.
Do you choose the physical therapist? Do you send them somewhere, or they go where they want?
They go where they want. I say, where's the closest physical therapist to you?
Do you order it? Do you fill out an order? Okay. Anything specifically that you ask for?
Well, reduce swelling.
Okay. The x-rays from... Dr. Foreman, have you seen any of those other physicians' notes or x-rays?
I saw one of the x-rays that it was visibly displaced.
Just got chastised. Yeah, that's a huge difference than what we see initially.
Yeah, because now look, you're starting to get widening.
Yeah. It may have broke medially.
Okay. And if you look right up in here, it looks like maybe it's a fracture. Because the osteotomy was made here, so that looks like maybe that arm that ran the distal part of the apex.
Dr. Campbell, for the record, what are you looking at?
I'm looking at the x-ray done by Dr. Justin Roberts at Tokyo.
Thank you.
It's a good x-ray.
No, the way they sit, there's like, this is an 8 millimeter, so that's what the distance between the arms are. And I do recall that in Dr. Vaughn's operative report, he noted that the staple was loose but not bent or angulated, or there was no inherent instability.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to break one of these staples.
No, I'm just saying so far.
Well, I suppose you could.
Not in a toe. It would be, yeah.
Rear foot, maybe.
But not, yeah, not in a toe. That's what I was, when there's movement there, and it's just creating a lot of stress. And
so, it appears as though the patient was very emotional about, she didn't feel like you were truthful with her after the surgery about there's a staple in her foot and what was going on. Can you comment on that?
Like I mentioned before, during the pre-op discussion, I mentioned that there's a staple in the foot. The x-rays are, every time we take an x-ray, it's up visible for the patient. I do go over the x-ray. It is visible when they go over it. I definitely mentioned that there'll be a staple.
Unless anybody else has any other questions.
So I wanted the patient to know that, of course, Dr. Foreman is disappointed with her outcome. No doctor wants to see a patient with an adverse outcome, but we have to go back and look at the case prospectively. It's good and interesting to look at the case at the end of the case, but again, I just want to remind the board that measuring or examining the standard that the law requires you to look at the case prospectively. And that means, what was Dr. Foreman thinking at the time, and was it reasonable? Not was it perfect, and not in the interest of hindsight, as we see the sequential x-rays from Dr. Vaughn and Dr. Roberts. That does turn on causation, and I think Dr. Foreman himself said when he saw those films that the staple was obviously no evidence that supports. I do see that the patient is very emotional, and I appreciate that, and I understand that. Sometimes emotion can create false impressions. That's not a criticism of her in any way, shape, or form. That's for all of us. But there's the information that Dr. Foreman shared with her was information he believed genuine from his objective review of the films, from his objective review of. And if we look at the standard of care, he saw the patient regularly, he took x-rays regularly, he looked at the x-rays, he made his objective assumptions of what those showed, and there were contributing factors, the distance, which he thought could have been attention, there's some questions about compliance, weight bearing, there's obviously questions about compliance because she did not timely attend physical therapy. Again, I'm not saying that caused but there's issues of compliance. But there's no evidence to support a lack of informed consent. Or shouldn't have known. This patient told you today she's an health insurance agent. She's highly sophisticated. And would have paid close attention. I would have thought would have paid close attention. But sometimes patients don't pay close attention when they're in pain. So I'm not faulting her. I'm just commenting on the evidence doesn't support a lack of informed consent. She wasn't told about the staple. Didn't know. Should have known. As to whether Dr. Foreman should have discovered the displaced staple earlier, I think that really is truly addressed through the report of Dr. Descant. And I would just refer to you because that really demonstrates, I think, his thinking, Dr. Foreman's thinking from a third party objective review. How can that happen? How can a staple be displaced? And I have to say, Dr. Leonetti, your explanation makes sense to me. But I didn't think that supported a finding of Dr. Foreman acted below the standard of care. So you can often have adverse outcomes. Doctor does everything which is reasonable, and I think that's what happened in this case. Dr. Foreman's conduct was reasonable. There's no evidence to support the lie to the patient. And even here, we sat and heard the patient contradict knowledge from her own current physicians. said she said she was told things, and she said she wasn't. And that just happens sometimes when you're in pain and you're in the course of a problem. Again, no criticism at all lodged. It just, when you're dealing with something, sometimes your memory is on you. I think the evidence supports that Dr. Moorman, and our response shows that at the initial surgery, he did not feel that the placement was ideal, but he felt that it was sufficient and it didn't justify removing the staple and inserting the wire at the operation. And that's a judgment call. And when we're dealing with judgment calls, we have to be very careful about imposing our own, what we would do, as opposed to, was that a reasonable conclusion by him? It may not be perfect. And if you have an adverse outcome, it's easy to say, well, this happened because he didn't take it out and put in a quick K-wire at the operation. If it had healed, we would have said, well, it was the right decision. But again, you don't measure standard of care in hindsight. That's the Monday morning quarterbacking. You measure standard of care prospectively. And I ask that you examine Dr. Foreman's behavior and conduct a prospective, not with the hindsight, not with 2020. And again, I just wanted to tell the patient that we're sorry, and we're hopeful that her recovery continues to improve.
I still have just a little. My concern is I think maybe things could have become more apparent soon. That's where I'm. That's exactly. We weren't in surgery. Kent mentioned, obviously, looking at standard of care, and that's where my concern is too much time delay in recognizing.
Okay. I think my concern would be that the Aiken osteotomy was a little bit too far proximal. I agree with Dr. Cohen on that. However, I mean, the idea is to put the osteotomy within about a centimeter of the articular cartilage. But there's a chance that even with a more distal osteotomy, that the lateral cortex breaks and this whole process starts to go downhill and spiral out of control, and we end up with this degenerative joint, which is apparently degenerative to begin with. So, but I think the fact that the proximal phalanx was in that soft subchondral bone when it broke and shifted made it easier for it to break through the cartilage or start the cartilage to wear out from underside and broke down. So that would be my issue. Probably would have immobilized the patient a little longer if I thought that the lateral cortex broke until I had signs that it was healed. But, you know, looking at the x-rays, and I believe these are 3/6/19, the osteotomy looks healed. It shifted, but it looks healed. But at that point, if it already shifted, the arm or the staple may have already moved, and the damage was done. Whatever was going to happen was going to snowball from that effect because it's no longer in the position that we wanted it to be. So that would be my concern. It's just the placement of the osteotomy a little farther distal would have been great, but this still could have happened regardless. And recognizing that the cortex broke and it shifted a little sooner may have immobilized the patient a little bit longer. That being said, this is a complication of these type of procedures. I sometimes think patients don't understand or don't fully engage when you're reviewing these postoperative complications preoperatively. They're really anxious and they're nervous about the procedure and they're thinking about healing time and pain. And I don't think they realize, I mean, we see it here all the time, how many bad things can happen with a fairly straightforward procedure. And I just think it's our job as physicians to really emphasize to patients what the potential complications can be. Even if it makes the patient step back and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe if I knew that's the possibility, I'm not going to do that. That's fine. You know, that's why we have informed consent, so that we can let those patients make that decision on their own. If they thought, oh, this might not heal, and I may develop arthritis, I may need to have multiple more surgeries, even though that's on your list, I still think patients sign things, and sometimes they don't really fully understand what the possibilities are. I just think we need to do as good a job as we can. You can't force people to understand, but I think you do as good a job as you can to let them know what the potential risks are.
I think that's why some people, too, will ask their patients, okay, tell me what you understand.
That's great.
To help you prevent, I mean, at least to arm yourself better with knowing kind of discussion. So everybody's on the same page.
I think that's a great suggestion, Dr. Campbell. It's not the standard practice in our community, but it would be a good recommendation.
It was always quite helpful. Yeah. So you tell me. Yeah. And if you don't understand, we're going to talk about it.
In my practice, I do the same type of thing with a little diagram, and I draw a little screw, not quite as artistic as you, Barbara, but I draw a little screw, and I'm shocked postoperatively how many patients say, oh, there's a screw in my foot.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, did we not understand that this was going to happen? And so I understand there's a lot of anxiety preoperatively, and maybe patients are worried about other things. Doing the best we can to let them know what the potential downside is really important. So
I don't believe that there's any, I would offer maybe just a letter of concern, just like thinking about osteotomy placements like we talked about, and also recognizing possibilities. Because I think, too, what happened here maybe, too, is when the patient loses confidence, they go off to somebody else. And I'm sure they could have been able to resolve.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were other options besides fusion.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion. But yeah, but when you see that picture that Dr. Roberts and Dr. Vaughn said as your first snapshot,
right? They haven't seen what happened.
They haven't seen where it came from, right? So, I agree.
Okay, so the board is contemplating issuing a letter of concern, and the board is concerned that Dr. Foreman did not recognize postoperative complications sooner.
The placement of the osteotomy,
okay,
and recognizing postoperative complications sooner.
Okay, and then issue with the okay. All right. The letter of concern. The board is concerned that Dr. Foreman did not recognize postoperative complications sooner, and should consider placement of osteotomies more carefully prior to surgery.
During surgery.
Was a motion.
That's my
second.
Any discussion?
Favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Is this your last day?
My last day.
Oh, how many years has it been?
21.
That's
I had
a long
babies
time.
In diapers. almost out of college. Yes.
And I'll be
thank
gone
you.
In 2 weeks, so.
And I will ask.
Yeah, it's going to be a new board.
It's going to be a whole new board.
Frankie's going to change too? Wow. I know they're. Where are you going to?
I took an in-house position over at a private university.
Good for you. Good for you.
Janet? Yes, I will. Yes.
Good luck, Dr. Leonetti.
Thank you.
For all your service.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You.
Back on record at 10:24. So we're going to go ahead and take investigation file 19-35-C, which is have our complaint. Still on the phone. He's been a very patient fellow.
Yeah. MZ?
Yes, I was. Come on now. Hello. Computer, don't do this to me. And our investigator is Dr. Cohn. So Dr. Cohn's going to go ahead and give his report, and then we will hear from you, sir. Okay?
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Dr. Cohn. Dr. Cohn, are you there?
He might
mute. Are you on mute here?
Gary.
Dr. Cohn?
Like, yeah.
Hello.
Hey, there he
is. I thought we lost you.
Sorry about that. I heard you.
We're on to Dr. Dahuki's case, 19-35-C.
No problem. Okay. So Dr. Dahuki's case, 19-35-C. Complaint is MZ. He alleged that care was not performed. He would also like to be refunded his copay and felt the fees were excessive. Dr. Dahuki's response included that he does have residents within the office, but he did perform the care for this patient. Standard procedures to request permission from the patient for a resident to participate in the care. Dr. Dahuki reinforced he always examines the patient to verify the findings and recommendations and to initiate that care. Patient was diabetic with neuropathy on a comitotic incurvated nails, and care was performed to consist of reduction of the nails. Dr. Dahuki notes that because of issues and concerns with the patient, he did write off any outstanding balances. As far as the medical records review, there was only one visit. The visit occurred June 13, 2019. Past medical history included diabetes and hypertension. MZ described pain on the bottom of the foot. Physical examination noted vascular status to be diminished. Neurologic, no significant deficits. Dermatology, there were no open wounds. Musculoskeletal, there were deformed digits. Nonspecific plantar pain, and it wasn't related to an interdigital neuroma. Described as a result of peripheral neuritis and neuropathy, the assessment was diabetes with polyneuropathy and onychomycosis, associated with the dermatophytosis and ingrowing nail. Diabetic foot care was performed. I did question MZ if he was aware that the charges that were not paid originally by insurance were written off. MZ stated he was aware but still wanted his copayment returned. He states he was unable to decide if the nails were cut by whom. I did speak with Dr. Dahuki, and I also spoke with Terry, Dr. Dahuki's office manager, separately. Discussion with Terry, it was confirmed that all the balances were written off. It was also confirmed that there were multiple instances of belligerence expressed by the patient that were documented within the notes. Dr. Dahuki, I discussed the care and who performed it. He verified that he does perform it. He also verified there was belligerence by the patient. Therefore, he decided that he elected not to attempt to proceed with any collection and to have the patient discharged. Supporting documentation included a memorandum by the office manager, Terry. Charges were 203 and 11721. As far as my conclusion, I felt the cases are substantiated. Dr. Dahuki was present within the room and upon discussion confirms he performed the care. The charges were not excessive and they were appropriate for the level of care and presentation and diagnoses. Therefore, my opinion is that this case is unsubstantiated. Thank you.
Anyone have any questions for Dr. Cohn?
I do not.
All right. Now, we can hear from our complaint. Sir, can give a summary of your complaint?
Well, personally, I would know if somebody cut my toenails, and that was not performed at all, ever. So they said they wrote it off only because I was a little upset with the fact that he was stating that he performed that procedure, and that also Terry, the manager, said that there was nobody else in the room. They document all the time that somebody's in the room. Nobody was in the room. I mean, there was. I wasn't imagining it. My wife was in the room with us. And hold on a second. I'm talking to them now, okay?
Okay, bye.
Bye. That was our pager. She was paging me. Anyways, he asked if the intern or the student studying could perform it. At least that's what I interpreted it as. And I told him, I said, no, I want you to do it. Let him watch. And basically, they just left the room right after. And he did have me take off my shoes and determine that I had, what do they call, hammer toe. And so that everything that you said, the normal procedures for this care is to cut toenails. Maybe that is the case, but that's not what happened. And I can't believe that he submitted it to the insurance company and they denied it, then turned around and sent me a bill that didn't even explain nothing on it. It just said $91. I sent a copy of the bill. And there's nothing explaining toenails cut or anything. So I had to call and ask, and that's what was told to me at that time by Terry. And when I was telling her that there was an intern with her in there with the doctor, and she was telling me no. And so I may have gotten a little belligerent, and I didn't really curse. I said damn a couple times, and all of a sudden I'm insulting her, and I could tell I wasn't going to get any further. So, but the end result is him trying to snowball the insurance company, then to turn around and try and get it from me. I also got a recording because I wanted to talk to Dr. Dahuki personally to hear him state it. And but before I talked to them, I thought to myself, well, they're going to turn this around and give it to a collection agency, and then it's going to be double the amount, and then the collection agency isn't going to listen to any excuses. They're just going to keep charging extra penalties or whatever. So I called the billing department at that place, and she told, that's when I found out that they were appealing the case, and that I wasn't responsible. I said, oh, really? And I said, okay. And so later, I got a call from Terry stating that Dr. Hookie was on the line. And I says, and this is where I don't understand where I was belligerent with Dr. Dahuki, because I think he's just backing up Terry's statement. But I right away said, am I understanding it correctly that you're not, I'm not responsible for the $91? And he said, yes. And I said, fine, have a good day. And we hung up. Excuse me. But I later checked my phone messages, and there was a message on there. And if you guys want to hear it, I can play it for you because I still have it. But it was stating that they were going to resubmit or appeal and put in that I had diabetes. That was never stated at the beginning or the first time they sent the the case to insurance. And but now they were going to appeal it, and this time put that I had diabetes, And then that made it, I think, more in their favor, the fact that normal procedure, if the patient has diabetes, this is what we do. We cut the toenails. Of course, my pain was on the bottom of my foot, which it's still there. I feel like I'm walking around on a marble or something. You know, it's just there. But that's neither here nor there. Now, I've been cutting my own toenails to try to alleviate that, because I can understand where it, you know, I'm really bad at doing my feet anyways. My whole life I was in the service and worked at the plant, and I wore steel toes all the time. And so that, I think, was the actual cause of my hammer toe. But the main thing is the fact that he's insisting that he performed something. I mean, why would I want to lie about cutting toenails? I mean, okay, if he did it, good. But that was not the case. And without being repeating myself, I really don't have more to say other than, do you want to hear the message that they left me?
I don't need to hear it.
I don't think we do, sir. But I do have a question for you. Did Dr. Dahuki offer you any treatment for the pain that you were having on the bottom of your foot?
Well, see, that's where he stated something, and I don't remember his exact words, other than the fact that I took it as he wanted the intern or the student studying to perform it. And right away I said no, pointing at, I want you to do it and let him watch. Because
yes,
I wanted it to be done by somebody that had the experience.
Of course, I understand that. But my question to you, sir, is you said you had pain on the bottom of your foot. Did Dr. Dahuki
right.
offer you any treatment for that?
I think he was saying something about shoes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir, did Dr. Dahuki examine you? Did he touch your feet? Did he feel your pulses, test your nerves?
No. He took my shoes off. He had me take my shoes off and right away determined that I had hammer toe, and I think he was treating the hammer toe and not my pain on the bottom of my foot. That's just non-professionally speaking.
But did he move your toe around and see if it would move? Did he palpate
nope.
it? No.
Nope.
Not at all.
Nothing.
And you maintained
that's what
it,
I said.
He did not trim your nails.
He did not trim my nails. And I have my wife here. She can state the same. She was in a wheelchair. I'm surprised he can't remember that, the fact that I had my wife in there with me, and she was in a wheelchair. If anything, that he would have remembered that. And the fact that, why would both of us lie?
Okay. But you agree that he did examine you?
No, not really.
He
not
didn't.
Thoroughly. I don't
well,
think so. But that's not the point. The point
well,
is the fact that he
no,
wanted
excuse me.
To...
Excuse me. It is the point.
Okay.
Because he billed two codes
right.
that morning. One code was for a new patient examination, and part of that is examining your feet. The second procedure was for a nail debridement. Now, the nail debridement was denied by your insurance company, but the new patient examination was approved, but there's a copay that goes with that. So I don't understand why you want your copay back. If he examined your foot, that's part of your responsibility, whether he trimmed your nails or
well,
not.
You just told me, you just asked me if he touched my toe, wiggled it, or anything, and I said no. He looked at my foot and saw that I had hammer toe, and right away, I would think, you know, professionally, in his case, that you would treat the hammer toe, and that would possibly do the pain on the bottom of the foot. I don't know.
Okay,
but
yeah.
But either way.
Yeah. It can. A hammer toe can cause pain on the bottom of the foot. But you're stating right now that he never touched your foot. He didn't put gloves on. He didn't feel your pulses. He didn't touch your toe or anything.
No, sir.
Did anyone else?
Did he?
No, he didn't.
Okay. No. I mean, not even the intern.
The nurses? Anyone that checked you in?
Nobody. Nope.
They didn't take his blood pressure. No vitals?
Did they take your blood pressure?
No, sir.
Okay, so that means that the note that we have from Dr. Duhuki is completely inaccurate in your opinion.
Everything he's stating is...
I don't know what to do here, because...
I mean, he's got a medical record.
Yeah.
He has a medical record that describes all these things were performed.
Right.
And if that's the case, then he owes a copay. It's not our concern. That's between him and his insurance company. But, I mean, it would have been helpful if Dr. Duhuki would be on the phone or be here so he could tell us that he examined the patient or not.
Cut his nails.
And trimmed his nails or not.
They're swearing up and down they did. And they swear that there wasn't an intern or student in there studying. So, I mean, they're calling me a flat-out
liar. He said there was a resident in there. He did not say there was not a resident in there. He said you specifically declined to have the resident examine you.
Right, okay.
No, he's
so
not
far,
saying that there was no one in there. So that's not an issue here.
Terry did.
Okay.
His office manager, when I called back, and that I was stating to her that he never performed it because I asked what was the $91 for because it wasn't clearly stated on the bill. So she said right away that it was for cutting toenails. And at that point, I said, no, he didn't cut my toenails. I mean, I don't quite understand here.
Yeah.
You know.
Dr. Duhuki was here. I mean, everything is stated
in his notes.
I didn't hear what you were saying. You were broken up.
Well, we have Dr. Duhuki's medical record that said he examined you and that he debrided your toenails. So that's, and I think maybe some of the confusion here, too, is the way they sent the bill to the insurance, they didn't mark on there that you were a diabetic, and so that's why it had to be resubmitted. But... and then we see that Dr. Duhuki elected to write out the balance, but you still, the fact that your insurance company allowed for the examination, you still have your copay. So since we were not there in the room with you, sir, we can't.
All right. Just because he put it down in his notes that it did doesn't mean that's what happened either. He's a flat-out liar to me.
Well, he may be, but we can't prove it because it's he said or she said. There was no one else in the room except you and your wife and he and the resident, and his notes say that he did it. But regardless, if you were seen in his office that day for an evaluation, it's a copay.
Because I was referred. I was referred to him by my PCP.
Right. Doesn't matter how you got there. Once you're there and there was an examination that occurred, you owe a copay. So that's between you and your insurance company. If you don't want to pay it, then talk to your insurance company.
I already paid it. That's the thing.
Right.
I paid the copay when I was there. But the fact that he's stating this, and you even asked if he took my pulse or wiggled my toes or anything. He didn't do that.
Well,
so how can you even base what you're saying?
Okay, because his records show that he did. And if he was here on the phone, he'd say he did it. You said he didn't. There's no way we can prove it. The insurance company didn't pay for the nail debridement anyway. But you saw him for an office visit. Therefore, you're responsible for the copay.
This is a waste of time, then. Have a good day.
Thank you.
So I will move to dismiss case 19-35-SC, seeing that there are no violations of state statute.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
All right. Our next one is 19-28-B, which is Dr. Eric Espenson. This came to our attention through the application.
The National Practitioner Database report.
Report.
There was a settlement date of March 8, 2019.
Right, and it appears that he was down at the SALSA program in at Tucson, Dr. Armstrong. He did a surgery on a patient that was in Austin, a bunionectomy with a screw fixation. Apparently, he only saw the patient for two post-op visits. He ended up having emergency knee surgery. The case was in by another colleague, and at 4 months post-op, apparently ended up going in and replacing painful hardware. He had been told prior that the fixation was, or that the osteotomy was well healed, but apparently he was not given his due process in knowing that about this complaint, wasn't allowed to participate in anything. Records are very minimal that came from.
Like there was an open case.
There wasn't.
Internally before right. It even got to that stage, so he wouldn't have been notified, especially when he works for a large hospital like that.
And that's, you know, those are all the findings that, you know, Dr. Cohn investigated.
Yes.
Investigated the case. Do you have anything to add, Dr. Cohn? I'm sorry I stole your position there for us.
Oh, no, you did well. There really wasn't. I mean, there's no x-rays. There was nothing for me to see. I think that this might have passed the lines in that, you know, with the National Practitioner Database in terms of when Dr. Espenson not even knowing the case was presented or settled just based on the dates. But, no, I did talk to him about the screw length because the screw was a little bit long depending on the procedure. And he did describe it as a long arm osteotomy on the first med head, which would typically require a screw of a 20 to 22 millimeter length versus a tip, you know, a standard Austin, which is a little bit shorter screw. So, no, I don't think there's anything here that we can find. I think Dr. Espenson even tried to do his best he can to help out.
And I think the fact that they're saying they don't have a fluoroscopy, but, you know, I went and looked on the surgical record, and you know, usually you have all that in there. If there's an x-ray person in that room, it's noted. And the only thing I could find that had anything to do with an image was they do an ultrasound image when they're doing their peripheral nerve block. That's the only thing that was in there. There's nothing listed on a fluoro, so, and I think maybe what happened too was because of what, there was some kind of internal political thing, the way he was released from that position, and then not allowed to participate is rather questionable.
I agree. Yeah, I really don't think we have enough information on this case to do much other than dismiss it. That's my recommendation, that we dismiss this case based on no violation of state statutes.
Dr. Foreman seconded that. So any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thanks, Dr. Cohn.
My pleasure. I think we're done for today, right?
We are done for today.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll move on.
And hey, I might give you a call offline just to, you know, say goodbye or something. Thanks.
Bye, Jerry.
All righty. So we have the next is issuance of licenses for Dr. Benjamin Thomas.
I was like, but it is on your flash drive.
Okay, it's on our flash drive.
Good, okay, good.
It's who we were talking about.
Yeah, this is the it should be a regular license, not a comedy license, because he was in his training. He did have a license from Utah, but that doesn't, you, it's private practice, so.
Right.
It's.
He has an employer in here.
Yes, but he started with them, wasn't till 17.
So you have to be, is it 5 years?
5 years.
You have to be 5 years in practice.
Years, yeah. 16. He started with them in 16. So yeah, that has to go through regular license. But everything else looks like it's fine. He's paid his fees and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So just for my clarification, I just send him a request to switch his application to by exam and then just request the additional documentation that we need, and it'll come back.
Probably, if he's already done everything through Salesforce, and he's going to
I can just switch his application to
Because on one, I think one part it does say regular license and not comedy. So it's like...
It's very weird.
It might have been listed both.
Well, he initially applied by universal recognition, which he does not qualify for because he's not a resident.
Okay.
He's a resident of Utah.
Okay.
So
it'll be a reg.
He'd have to withdraw that and go back into the system and apply by comedy. Because the conversation him and I had, he's been licensed for 5 years.
I think you're fine administratively, just switching the application and asking for the missing documentation.
And if everything's fine with the board, then you can probably just have it come back in December.
So I will make a motion to issue Dr. Benjamin Thomas a license once the rest of the documentation has been received.
So once the proper application and documentation are filed.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Yes, right, yeah. And the next we have are the applications for registration to dispense drugs and devices. Bradley Neuschwander and Lauren Worcester. Looks like everything's okay with them. Fees are paid and applications are...
Yep. So I move to accept their application for dispensing drugs and devices.
I second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And we have our compliance updates for Drs. Brad Heyman and Dr. Patrick Farrell. So Dr. Farrell has not performed any nerve decompressions in September, but he has one in October. So then that...
Dr. Cohn, and he is required, Dr. Farrell is required to submit a list of his patients for Dr. Cohn to choose from by December 11th because it was a 3-month audit that we're doing. So I'm hoping that we can review that in probably February because it's mid-December. So I don't know if Dr. Cohn will have the report ready for the January meeting.
Last minute from Dr.
Yesterday I got an email from Dr. Heyman. It was yesterday afternoon. Just please inform the board that I have not performed any osteotomy cases during the past month.
He must have a notification on his iPhone. That, Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Sent an email to Heather. Same as last month.
That for Dr. Heyman would be the month of?
During the past month, it would have
been October.
In the October. Next is the 2020 legislation. Heather.
Yes. I received correspondence from Michelle Hannigsberg with Legislative Council. She is the one who's drafting the bill based on what I gave her that the board approved at its last meeting. And the section regarding fees, the way it's written right now, it would open up a Proposition 108, which would require two-thirds majority vote. Michelle Hannigsberg did say that there is more general language that can be used for that section, and it could be language such as the board has the authority to create fees for, and then, you know, the following: audio files, public records requests, and then we could put that in rule. And if we wrote it that way, it would not open up a Proposition 108. So the board is going to have to determine what route they want to go. I did speak with Melissa Taylor, a policy advisor at the Senate, and her opinion was that going with a more general language would be more appropriate. Just make it easier for the board.
It's very difficult to garner a two-thirds vote across the...
And if we didn't get a two-thirds vote...
Legislature, especially for a fee. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
and if we don't get the two-thirds vote, the entire bill goes away. It's not just that section.
But the general language would allow you guys to set your own rules.
Yes. Yeah, so we'd have to go through.
General, according to your rules, you have established fees. So the general language would be like you can establish fees and rule, and then you would go and do rulemaking instead of having a statutory change.
Is the association is not involved in this at all, are they?
I've spoken with Mr. Abadi, Joe Abadi, with the association, and he said that he is willing to help the board in whatever way he can. He'll go to any meetings. So I've been keeping him updated.
Good.
But I haven't had any requests for meetings. I've reached out to several people, over at the legislature, and I've asked, if they have any questions, so let me know. If they want to set up a meeting, to let me know. I haven't had any requests.
It's a tricky year with the
election. Yeah. I would just keep the door open with Mr. Abadi. He tends to have a really good feel for how the legislators are leaning and which ones are in favor of us and which ones are not.
And the other issues the board wants to address today would be the APMA Code of Ethics. The board has talked about that a couple of times in response to a complaint that the board reviewed that the board really didn't have jurisdiction over. So I did include the APMA Code of Ethics.
There are several sections in there that really go for our previous concern about harassment in the workplace.
So if the entire code of ethics is not something you would like to regulate, you can incorporate a section by reference if you'd like, because I see that's broken up into like managed care issues and business issues.
Advertising.
I would guess that you would not really want to get involved in the business side of things.
No.
But I think it would be really important for the board as a whole to review the code of ethics. And maybe if there's specific sections that are more relevant to the practice of podiatry in your regulation, that might be something you want to isolate and incorporate by reference instead of incorporating the entire document by reference. Once again, if you incorporate the entire document, you're opening up your door to other complaints that you may not have entertained in the past.
Right. I agree.
So this is something that I would urge you to take a careful look at. Choosing what you'd like to include.
Okay. Is it possible to get a printable version of this? Because you're going to take
printable version of
the APMA Code of Ethics.
So
I can look at it or send it to us online somewhere that we can refer to it back so we can decide what or.
We just want the harassment parts.
We just want the harassment parts.
Because a lot of this is already covered within your statute,
yes,
so you don't want to duplicate.
Right, overplay.
Exactly. But you want to also do it in a general enough way that if you look at, let's say if we didn't have an informed consent section, that you would say, ME 2.0, the entire section, incorporated by reference. That way, if they ever make changes to it, it's already incorporated into your statutory change.
6.0.
Can you explain to Albert what we're doing here?
We had a case recently concerning doctors' behavior in off-site, like in surgery centers and things. In our statutes, we have statutes against inappropriate behavior towards patients, but not everybody else. So what we were trying to do was incorporate into our statutes and rules some kind of code of ethics or some language concerning harassment of people, like a nurse you might work with in a surgery center or even your own staff. So it allowed, because we couldn't adjudicate anything because we didn't have a statute. So that's why we're going, looking at this, is to somehow incorporate something so that this is considered, you know, we have some looking at, this is unprofessional conduct.
And Mr. Stoner did put out the call for comment, and he
emailed
me the responses. And you might want to look at Oregon if you don't want to incorporate just a section of the statute, like Oregon's language, the way they have it written. So
Dr. Yolanda, what Heather did was, we had the Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards, and so she talked to Russell Stoner, who's the executive director, and what he did was he puts out a call to comment to other member boards, state boards that are members of the Federation, and ask him what is it that they do, what's in their statutes, to kind of give us, you know, just an idea of what's going on out there and help us in our direction.
And I'm looking at BE 6.0. I mean, it's two small sections, and really the harassment, I think, was what the board had a major concern about. If nothing else is even relevant in here, you don't even have to incorporate by statute. You can just pull this out and then make a new statute in your unprofessional conduct.
Okay.
Is the other option. So if that truly is the only thing in the Code of Ethics that you don't think that your current statutes covers, we could pull that out and put it in there.
Yeah, because when I read through those again, I thought, well, there's so much of this is just already.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In our statutes in some degree. But this is what we were looking for.
Mm-hmm. And the harassment... Exactly, the harassment, it's pretty clear cut right there. So
just having that become a new statute. Yeah. That makes sense to do it, you know. Do you have any questions about that, Albert?
And just for my clarification, so just it's the BE 6.1 harassment, just that one section.
Yeah, because it looks like there's, BE 6.11.
A lot of the other stuff is repetitive.
Yeah, they do. There are several areas where, again, then it shows up again later in the document under two different, like ME 4.3.
Okay, yeah, so ME 4.3 is just the Title 7.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. So. Again, yeah, there's a lot of repetition.
And I think your statutes do a lot of patient care, but not so much with professional settings.
I'd probably reference that section instead of 6.1. You're doing an overview on fall-related harassment and...
Right.
Yeah, I think that whole section is... I think even the BE 6.21 goes towards that one case that we had where he was making the Pocahontas remarks.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that, because that's the non-discriminatory clause. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that whole section is great.
Okay.
Yeah, all of 6.0.
Okay. Plus the subsection.
Yeah, so 6.0 includes 6.11 and 6.0. Under the heading of 6.1 harassment.
So under the unprofessional conduct statute, where I made the changes.
Yeah, I was going to look at that next. Where did you? Under regulation, right? Regulation.
I added number 28, so I can just take out number 28 and add section 6.0.
Yes. So yeah, just, and then I would take that out and then see if you can't finagle
lost my other fish. You know, a failure to avoid interaction that would impair the physical and psychological health of those with whom we interact with on a professional basis. And then you can even add on, you know, the podiatrist non-engaged examples of the deliberate act of emotional abuse, physical abuse. Yeah. I can help you. Okay. As long as it's in the next 2 weeks.
And Michelle Hanningsburg will...
Oh, you got Michelle.
Yeah, so I'll give her general language and then
Just cut and paste that little section out and just have her somehow enable that into the 28 along with my consistent language so it doesn't look weird.
And before we go on to the next issue regarding merging the two applications, if the board can let me know what they want to do with the fee section, the 32-830. For those fees that I inserted for the wallet card, wall certificate, and just if for duplicate wallet cards, duplicate wall certificates, if the board would prefer to go with general language, giving the board the authority to create fees and rule, or if you want to keep it as is and just knowing that it would open up Proposition 108.
I think we need to go with the general because you know that could.
It could stonewall your entire bill.
At number 4.21, it basically says that you can't deny anything to anyone for any reason.
What are you looking at?
That you have to take.
Oh, yeah, they're not going to include that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That you're mandated to take it.
No. We're not going to do that. We're doing, E6.0
wallet cards.
Yeah.
The only part of this whole document that we're going to incorporate is
I have a stack of them still on my desk.
And this.
All those
so
years.
This section right here is the only part we're going to incorporate.
Okay.
So that was, remember that case?
Yeah. Did you ever actually use the wallet card?
Yeah. So this, that right there, if we had had that to start with, he could have been disciplined under that.
Yeah.
And then this is also going to protect any coworkers from.
Can you imagine having Google at school?
What a difference.
The next issue that the board may want to address is when we merge the initial application with the initial application to dispense. That means that every applicant moving forward will also have a registration to dispense.
Right.
But what does the board want to do with current licensees who do not hold a registration to dispense?
Like for me, example. Mm-hmm. I don't maintain mine anymore because I'm not in active clinical practice.
And we have some doctors that don't even have a DEA registration.
And I don't either. I mean, I retired mine, so.
So will those current licensees be grandfathered in? But moving forward, and then how does that work with renewals?
Because that's when we had tried with Heather Carter to do that legislation. And then that was the time at the opioids where we just said, no, because they're going to freak out when they see this dispense.
The concern going forward with this is you have a 30%?
It's about 35% licensees.
35% of your licensees do not have dispensing. That means that when they renew, we're going to need to know what to do with them. Are you going to force them to submit a registration form? Or are you going to grandfather them in and just say you're okay, with the understanding that they still have to pay the higher fee?
Yeah, so the big thing is they have to pay the higher fee.
Yes.
I mean, every other state that I know of that I've ever been licensed in, they don't have this separate.
So if they
once you're licensed to dispense out of your office, because that's part of the overall umbrella.
Okay, so hypothetically, if I'm a doctor and I've been licensed with this board for 15 years and I have never had a DEA registration, that's not something that I do. I'm okay paying the higher fee. I don't have anything to register with you because I don't even have a DEA number.
Well, you don't.
Are you going to require them to file a form?
No. Because you don't need, if you're not dispensing drugs or writing prescriptions, you don't need a DEA number. But if you're dispensing orthotics or you're dispensing braces or this has been morphed into, you don't need a DEA number. So they don't technically need a DEA number to dispense
logistically,
drugs
what's on the application that
we ask for a we require a DEA number.
But what else is on the application that you wouldn't have asked for on the original?
We should just grandfather them
the
in.
The DEA certificate of registration
so
and the DEA
do you
number.
Even need a separate application for dispensing?
Yeah, that's
what
we this is really about the
okay.
fee.
And these, you know, what was weird years ago was when this all popped up, that, oh, you haven't been collecting, you haven't been getting registrations for doctors to dispense.
I have a suggestion about potentially changing, I know you're going to talk with Belfort, potentially changing your application so that the disclosure of the DEA number is on there, and they would have to opt in to put, if they're going to dispense. They would say, if you intend to dispense orthotics or drugs in the office, you must provide a DEA registration or a mark here if you're not going to. So they would still have to pay the full fee, but at least we wouldn't have to collect a whole registration certificate for each person that
right.
that we have don't have one on file for. Is that
doable? Yeah, it'll be some work on the IT side of it, but yes,
that'll reduce your paper. Have a whole separate application right now for the registration. If this is going to get merged, you can eliminate that, put it on your renewal application, and they can opt in.
Yeah, that's the whole idea behind this is eliminate the two different registrations.
Exactly.
Get one fee. If they want to dispense, they can dispense. If they don't, they don't. If you want to have a checkbox on the reapplication, fine. That's good.
Okay.
But they need to understand that they're still going to pay the fee.
Yeah, you're paying the fee.
Oh. That would just
no one's getting out of that.
Well, and the way it'll be written, it's going to be required that they pay that.
So yeah, I would see if there's any way to change the application so that they can, and then just with like the notification saying like if you intend to dispense, then you'll need to provide DEA mark here if you're not planning to dispense. So that have to
I have about 9 months, 10 months for IT to get that done.
Yes.
So hopefully,
but I think maybe that might be
top
a good
of their game over there.
If it passes.
Yeah,
I think so.
Right. I was thinking about that last night. I'm like, how do we do this? Okay.
And so our fee then is, what's the fee will be? What's $275 for a re-app plus one? So it'll be $375 for renewals. And initials will be?
No, it'll be $650. I'm sorry, $650.
For initials?
And that was a question that Michelle asked me when I spoke with her. Is the cap in statute is 1,000 for an initial application. I told her we didn't need to raise that. I didn't think it was necessary. We're at 650 now. Because, again, that would go under that Prop 108 clause. So I think that was all of the areas that I wanted to bring to the attention to the board.
You have the fingerprinting on there.
Yep, I included the amended statutes again for the board to look at. And it was already after I had left for the day yesterday, but Michelle did email me a draft of the legislation. So I'll bring that to the December board meeting because now we're going to have these additional changes.
And the records retention, bringing it to the same thing that's a normal medical
yep.
for the state.
Down
the
year. I pretty much took the exact language from the overarching
there.
Statute. So.
Much longer.
So, okay. So that's all. Radiology, yes.
I believe. You guys need a little legal advice on me. Can we get an executive session on that?
Yes. I will move to executive session for the purpose of receiving legal advice. And do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Let me read our statement regarding executive session. Did you take mine?
Oh, I hope not.
Move on. That's been satisfied. Our consent agenda for A is that we have a renewal for license
Oh, Arizona Podiatric License and a Dispensing Registration for a Dr. Arnold Wolf.
Yeah, I didn't see anything.
There's nothing. Was this already issued?
He was just on the consent agenda. He was one of those licensees who got the 60-day extension because he didn't complete the three-hour opioid. Mm-hmm. So, and with the consent agenda, you're never provided materials.
So he's completed it.
Oh,
yeah.
We have to vote?
Yes, so he's on this late because his deadline was just up.
Yes.
So that's a reapplication?
Yes.
So I would make a motion to accept Dr. Wolf's reapplication.
Mr. Rhodes seconded. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right, so Heather, your rest of your executive director's report.
Still do not have any correspondence from the governor's office regarding the two exemption requests from the rulemaking moratorium. I'm still waiting to hear back on the temporary license fee and on prorating the initial license issuance fee. I have been following up with Ms. Rajakovich about once a month. So as soon as I get any word on that, I will continue with that process. I did meet with Susie Myers regarding OSPB's determination that the board can sustain for another 14 years. And Ms. Myers, when she reevaluated her 10-year study, that was worst-case scenario, and she determined that the board can sustain for about 8 years. So with the budget, I put the updated budget. It's projected right now that the board is going to have about 20,000, a little over 20,000, left over from the appropriation. So Susie Myers' opinion was that if that continues and that amount reverts back each year, that we could sustain for another 14 years. So my recommendation would just to be wait another 4 or 5 years and then try to increase fees at that time. So we want to sustain longer than 14 years. but we have time at least before we raise fees. And my only other item, other than the new board member, but everybody now knows that, was the 2020 calendar. I attached that to an email, and I put it in your red travel folders. Because I had such a hard time getting rooms for 2020, I just booked everything through 2023.
Oh, wow.
So we always have this room. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Woo.
Yeah. So I think that the only – there's only two
away from climate change.
Yes. We'll be underwater by then.
There's only two dates in 2020 where we're not going to be in boardroom C, but they're on the second Wednesday. And then November was the only other.
So the board.
Yeah, there's just no Wednesday available. And I think it's because of Thanksgiving, people going on out of town, you know, Veterans Day.
November 10th and November 17th are the two options, and they're both Tuesday.
And November 11th is the Wednesday, but it's Veterans Day.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the board wants to have a board meeting right before holiday, or if you would prefer to have it November 17th. I have the room booked for both days, so it doesn't have to be a decision that's made today.
Yeah. Oh, people
you can sit on it, yeah.
Okay, so we can just bring that up later on. And then I put the updated complaint log that I printed that yesterday. I've had nothing since then. And then I gave you the updated budget. So I think, unless you guys have any questions, that was all I had for you.
On e-licensing on there, have been some developments?
I haven't had any problems.
Okay.
No, because they tried to increase fees, but that was shut down.
How many doctors didn't re-up, did you say? Did you have a number on that didn't send their reapplications back in?
The renewals, let me get that. It wasn't that many, but I did track it. It
shouldn't be, but there's always a couple.
So I expired out.
Right now, how many current active licenses?
Get another position at the House of Delegates.
What?
Should we get another position at the House
All right.
of Delegates?
Oh, are you going to go again, Jeff?
No.
No. You're done with that?
But those 23, their license has expired. They can no longer practice.
I'm sorry.
On extensions or anything? Those 23?
Correct.
They're done. They're
Correct.
And no longer allowed to practice.
Mm-hmm. We have one additional licensee who I'm waiting on information. It was Dr. Papalardo, the licensee who came before the board, and you granted her the extension.
Oh, she had a medical condition. Yeah.
Yes, and I want to say that her information is due like December 4th. It's very beginning of December, so she's the only one I have left.
Okay.
Yay.
Very good.
Summary of current events.
I'd just like to announce officially that this is my last board meeting with the Board of Podiatry, and it has been a fantastic 5 years serving you. Thank you very much. I will miss you greatly. I just had my 5-year anniversary last week.
Aww.
So, and if anyone would like beef jerky before I take the rest of this, please help yourselves.
Thank you, Frankie. Good luck.
We will miss you, but it's wonderful that you have an opportunity for yourself that
right.
will enhance your life professionally and personally and all those good things. And
who says that's beef?
It's roadkill.
I will love my roadkill jerky all the way home.
So we don't have any call to the public. Anybody have anything they want put on future agenda item? Our next board meeting is the 11th of December. And at 11:31, I will move to the
Good.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? No moved. Wonderful.
I am having my knee R&R'd on December 31st.